Hello, listeners. It's Friday, and this is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, October 27th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's look at the weather forecast first thing. And let me just say, it was cold this morning when I went out to feed the cats. It was cold. It felt like winter. Our forecast today comes from KCRG-TV. Temperatures drop after morning cold front. Shower chance. Big changes to our weather are arriving today, with the well-advertised chill moving into the state. A cold front will move through the area early today, with winds shifting behind it to the northwest and getting somewhat strong. This will usher in colder temperatures in a decent hurry, with highs before sunrise in the 50s and 60s, falling into the 40s by lunchtime and beyond. A few showers or even a storm are possible along and just behind the front, but that chance decreases throughout the day as well. Don't expect conditions to be similar when you leave work or school when you head out this morning. Plan ahead for the change. With winds getting lighter tonight and skies turning clear, we're headed for very chilly conditions overnight. A freeze warning is in effect for much of the area, with lows set to fall below freezing for multiple hours. This is just the first of several more hard freezes to come over the next several days, heralding an end to the growing season in eastern Iowa. A couple of disturbances move through the Midwest over the weekend, giving us a few chances for some precipitation. This could come in the form of rain or snow showers from Saturday into Sunday. The activity on Saturday looks more likely north of U.S. Highway 20, with a chance area-wide on Sunday. On both occasions, overall amounts look pretty light, and any significant impact from wintry precipitation looks unlikely. A few spots in the north on Saturday could see a dusting on grassy surfaces if snow is able to fall fast enough to outpace melting due to the warm ground and air temperatures. Highs both days appear in the upper 30s to 40s across the area. Cold air hangs around next week, too, with highs only in the 30s to low 40s for the first few days. A fast-moving disturbance swings into the region from the north on Tuesday, providing another shot at some light rain or snow showers. Windy conditions could accompany this, too, making for a blustery and chilly Halloween. A modest warm-up looks possible late next week, with highs getting back toward the low 50s by next Friday into Saturday. We have two stories to read on the front page of the Courier today. The first is titled, Governor Defends Library Book Law, and the subheading says, Still No Guidance from State as Schools Pull Books from Shelves. The story was written by Caleb McCullough and Tom Barton of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines. Governor Kim Reynolds defended a state law that requires schools to pull books with descriptions of sex acts from library shelves during a press conference on Wednesday, as the state's Department of Education said it may provide more guidance to schools navigating the restrictions. The law, passed by Iowa's legislative Republicans and signed into law by Reynolds this year, requires that school libraries only include, quote, age-appropriate material and specifically bans any book that describes or depicts any of a list of defined sex acts. The law also requires schools to notify parents if a student requests to be called by a different name or set of gender pronouns, and bans teaching about gender identity or sexual orientation in kindergarten through sixth grade. Schools must also provide a policy to request removal of any classroom materials and request parental permission before a student takes a survey or exam to assess the student's mental, emotional, or physical health that is not required by state or federal law. Reynolds read the list of sex acts written in law that would warrant a removal from libraries and said the standard should be clear on what is and is not allowed in schools. Quote, I'm not sure why any kindergartner or anybody in school should be subjected to that, and what value that brings to them, Reynolds said. So that's the definition. It's very, very clear, unquote. According to a database maintained by the Des Moines Register, districts in Iowa have removed at least 450 books from their shelves in response to the law. Many districts have removed commonly challenged books like Gender Queer and The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, books that are often assigned high school reading like George Orwell's 1984 and Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, have also been pulled by several districts. Education and library advocates have argued an overly broad interpretation of the law by school districts trying to avoid legal repercussions will lead to schools pulling materials off library shelves that should not be removed under the law, depriving students of the opportunity to read books they otherwise would. Speaking about the removal of commonly assigned books, Reynolds suggested school districts are implementing broad restrictions because they don't like the law. And she said the books that fall under the definition of a sex act in law should be clear. Quote, I think it's pretty clear. And if they can't distinguish that, then I don't know. Maybe we ought to look at what they should be dealing with, Reynolds said. Quote, it's just a distraction, and they don't like it, so they're blowing it out of proportion, unquote. Reynolds tied the effort to remove books with sexual content from schools to the need to boost scores in reading, math, and other areas that have lagged because of learning loss from the pandemic. Quote, our kids and our teachers deserve better, she said. They deserve the tools to help these kids succeed, not a damn distraction on a nasty pornographic book that should never, ever be in a classroom, unquote. Guidance still possible. The Iowa State Board of Education has until December 28th to begin promulgating rules to implement several provisions of the law. However, it remains unclear whether state officials will issue new rules or guidance related to removing school library materials and instruction related to sexual orientation or gender identity that's now barred in kindergarten through sixth grade. Heather Doe, communications director for the Iowa Department of Education, did not specify which provisions of the law for which the State Board of Education will promulgate rules. A specific date for the board to consider proposed rules has not been set yet, Doe said. The standard rulemaking process takes at least 108 days, but no more than 180 days, she added. Penalties for violating the law take effect on January 1st. State officials will give first-time offenders a written warning. Subsequent violations could lead to superintendents and employees being called before the Iowa Board of Educational Examiners for a hearing and possible disciplinary action, according to the law. Iowa Department of Education officials this summer left vague their plans to give school administrators more guidance on what constitutes age-appropriate material and which books would or would not fall under that definition, including materials referencing any type of gender identity and sexual orientation. The board's president during a meeting this summer noted school officials and administrators across the state have clamored for guidance from the department in implementing the law, in part to avoid the possibility of litigation over book removals. Melissa Peterson, legislative and policy director with the Iowa State Education Association, the state's largest teachers' union, said by her reading of the law, it does not compel rulemaking by the state board related to school library materials, but it does for other less controversial provisions. Left to seek their own legal advice, some schools initially removed hundreds of books, while others have waited, hoping for direction from the state before the law's penalties go into effect on January 1st. Peterson pointed to the Urbandale Community School District, which paused its initial removal of nearly 400 books from shelves that may violate the law, narrowing the list down to 64 titles after more careful review. The Iowa City Community School District this month released a list of about 70 book titles removed from schools to comply with the new law. The list includes Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, which tells the story of a young black girl after the Great Depression, and Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, a futuristic dystopian novel set in a patriarchal, white supremacist, totalitarian state, which has overthrown the U.S. It also includes A Thousand Acres, a novel written by Jane Smiley, a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa. Peterson said ISEA continues to be disappointed that the Iowa Department of Education has not issued better guidance to schools on how to navigate the thornier provisions of the law. Peterson said she's cautiously optimistic the State Board of Education will compel the department to issue guidance at its next meeting on November 15th. Quote, "We have a lot of important work ahead of us in public education, and when you take into consideration staff shortages and the needs of students, unnecessary distractions are not appreciated at this point," unquote. Quote, "And we think this issue in particular has been a significant distraction that could easily be removed with clear guidance from the Department of Education. We shouldn't be making it harder for folks to do their job and be in compliance," unquote. U.S. leadership needed to ensure Middle East's ability, official says. The story was written by The Courier's Aaron Murphy, and it does have an Iowa connection. The dateline is Johnston. "It is critical that America remain a moral compass to help Israel both now and beyond next year's presidential election," Israel's consul general to the Midwest said Thursday in Iowa. Yenin Cohen discussed the Israeli-Hamas war and the rise in anti-Semitism in the U.S. during this weekend's episode of Iowa Press on Iowa PBS. Cohen praised U.S. President Joe Biden for his leadership on the world stage since the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel. He also expressed his appreciation for the widespread bipartisan support for Israel from the U.S. Congress. Quote, "President Biden really showed a lot of leadership since the beginning of the violence in our region, since the heinous attack that cost the lives of more than 1,400 Israelis," Cohen said. Quote, "He has really been a moral compass, not only here in America, but also to the world. And his leadership and setting the goal for really eliminating Hamas, and this is very important," unquote. Republican candidates for president who have spent a lot of time campaigning in Iowa before the state's first-in-the-nation Republican caucuses have been discussing the Israel-Hamas war on the campaign trail. Cohen said regardless of who wins next year's presidential election, the U.S. must lead the world with its values. Quote, "We want the world to be led by the values of freedom and democracy of America, not by other values that are promoted by other countries, maybe in the other side of the world," Cohen said. Quote, "We need the world to be led by America. We need the world to be led by the values of freedom and democracy. And this is why I think it is very important that America continues to play a major role in setting the right moral compass for the world," unquote. While discussing the conflict, Cohen said he agrees with Biden's remarks earlier this week, in which he said it is important for Israel's military to focus its effort on eradicating Hamas and not at the expense of the Palestinian people who live in Gaza. Cohen said Israel is coordinating daily with the U.S. administration on every humanitarian issue, including efforts to help American citizens currently in Gaza. Estimates put that number at roughly 500 to 600 who are trying to leave. Quote, "I think the President Biden is very correct because we have declared war on Hamas. Hamas is a terrorist organization that is inspired, financed, and trained by Iran. Their only aim is not to advance Palestinian well-being or the two-state solution or whatever that would be. their declared goal is to destroy the one and only true state, the state of Israel, and to kill as many Jews as they can, Cohen said. Quote, so we have declared war, and our goal is to eradicate the leadership and the terrorist capabilities of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, unquote. At the same time, he said, Israel is well aware of the civilian population in Gaza and that the nation will really try to distinguish between Hamas and civilians. If Israel's military is successful in eliminating Hamas, a coalition of nations must help broker a long-term solution for peace in a region that has not had peace for decades, Cohen said. Quote, this is the most important question. When we think of the military goal, fully eradicating Hamas's capability of perpetuating terror attacks, we should also think of the day after the war. How should the Gaza Strip be ruled and managed? Cohen said. Quote, I think that the most important thing on the day after is to make sure that both the international community, but also our Arab friends and allies in the region, to make sure that the day after Hamas, they are able, the Palestinian population there, to set a roadmap and future for the civilian population there for a better life, better infrastructure, better education, eradicating the radicalism that is so deeply rooted right now among the population. Quote, this is our goal. It is a plan, a roadmap for the next years. And we need the whole international community and the Arab allies to do that, unquote. Cohen also expressed concern for a spike in anti-Semitic incidents around the world, including in the U.S., since the October 7th attacks. According to preliminary data from the Anti-Defamation League, reported anti-Semitic incidents of harassment, vandalism, and assault from October 7th to October 23rd increased by 388% over the same period last year. Iowa Press airs on PBS at 7 p.m. Friday and at noon on Sunday and at 8:30 a.m. Saturday on Iowa PBS World. And the program can also be viewed at the Iowa Press website. Waterloo and Cedar Falls to trick or treat on Halloween. After the switch was made in 2022, it's back on the holiday now. Story written by Melody Parker. It's back. Trick-or-treating will take place on Tuesday. In both Waterloo and Cedar Falls, beggars' night hours are from 6 to 8 p.m. Children should be accompanied by an adult. Residents who want to participate in handing out candy to ghouls, goblins, witches, Barbie and Ken, and other scary costumed characters should turn their porch lights on. Last year, Cedar Falls and other Cedar Valley communities held their trick-or-treating on a weekend rather than on Halloween. Quote, though the response from parents, teachers, and students was very positive for the Saturday night event, so I don't regret doing that last year, the rest of the Cedar Valley is sticking with October 31st. I would foresee an increased public safety risk and burden in doing a beggar's night on a different night than the rest of the Cedar Valley. So, October 31st it is, Mayor Rob Green said in a news release. Motorists should drive slowly through neighborhoods, and children should carry glow sticks or flashlights along with their trick-or-treat bags. Halloween masks and makeup should allow for good vision. The University of Northern Iowa's American Chemical Society student chapter will host its annual Halloween house from 4:30 to 7:30 p.m. on Friday on the second floor of the McCollum Science Hall. The event is free and open to the public. Students will be performing Halloween-themed science demonstrations and supervising hands-on activities in rooms such as Pirate's Cove, Frankenstein's Lab, Haunted Harvest, and Shadow Play. The hands-on activities are intended for children, and costumes are encouraged. Children of all ages, along with the whole family, will find the science demonstrations entertaining and informative. Quote, Halloween House is one of my favorite events of the year, and I would highly recommend coming to watch The Magic of Science. It also is completely put on by the science clubs at the university, which makes it even better. Megan Unger, co-president of the American Chemical Society student chapter, said in a news release, "On Saturday from 10 a.m. to noon, kids in Halloween costumes can trick-or-treat in downtown Waterloo. There will be games and activities as well, sponsored by Main Street Waterloo. On Tuesday, the Cedar Falls Downtown District will host trick-or-treating from 3:30 to 5 o'clock p.m. Merchants will be set up outside their stores, handing out candy and watching the parade of costumed kids and their parents strolling sidewalks in the district." Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center concert series puts live music in a whole new light. This story was written by Melody Parker. Dateline Cedar Falls. Steve Carrington has been buying batteries lately. Lots of batteries. Enough batteries to power the 2,000 flameless candles that will provide lighting for a series of candlelight concerts beginning Friday, presented by the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center. The Petrichord Quartet, a string ensemble from the University of Northern Iowa, will perform at 7:30 p.m. at the former Waterloo Masonic Temple at 325 East Park Avenue, now Park Avenue Lofts. The performance is in partnership with the Youth Art Team, which also has its office there. The historic building has undergone restoration, but until recently, the main hall was not open to the public. Limited to 250 people, the inaugural concert will be a unique experience, said Carrington, GBPAC Executive Director and UNI Associate Dean of Special Programs. Concertgoers will experience live music in intimate settings, illuminated only by candlelight. Quote, "Truly, the only light will be these candles, and it will be quite lovely. It will be a little like going to a candlelight church service or a romantic dinner. We've been filling up the candles with batteries and testing them all. They're remote controlled, and the candles will flicker like real candles," Carrington explained. Formerly known as the Cedar Valley Revealed series, the candlelight concerts will be performed in select locations. In addition to Friday's event, concerts are planned February 3rd at the Cedar Falls Women's Club, on March 2nd at the Brown Derby Ballroom in Waterloo, and on April 14th at the Three Pine Farms in rural Blackhawk County. Carrington pointed to the previous series, as well as the center's successful summer block party series, which took place in various Cedar Falls neighborhoods, as the genesis for the candlelight concerts. Quote, "We found that the block parties became more about community and actually made other events and activities happen around the music, created links and synergy, and engaged people," he explained. Quote, "We've also been doing chamber music, jazz and classical, on stage for 7 years, and that has maximum seating for about 250 people. What we found is putting musicians closer to the audience creates a bond that's quite special and personal. That makes the experience richer," unquote. Candlelight amps up the intimacy, creating an exceptional and cool event, he noted. Center staff will go a day early to set up and test candles and customize spaces to create the environment for musicians and audience. Concerts will feature musicians playing unplugged, but not all performances will be classical music. On Friday, the Petrichord Quartet, featuring Emma Baker and Lauren Gerlings on violin, Julian Perez on viola, and Turner Sperry on cello, will feature selections from the Beatles, Haydn, and others. Other performers in the series will include the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony Orchestra and Katie and the Honky Tonks. General admission tickets are $30 for adults and $10 for youth, available at unitix.uni.edu or by calling area code 319-273-4849 or toll-free 877-549-7469. or at the box office located at the Strayer Wood Theater on the UNI campus. And that's open 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Monday through Friday. Now we have the Metro Briefs column, Dateline Cedar Falls. Engineers will hold public information meetings from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. Thursday for two big road reconstruction projects. Residents interested in the North Cedar Heights Phase 2 project are asked to go to City Hall at 220 Clay Street. Those interested in the West Viking Road project must go to the Public Works facility at 2200 Technology Parkway. North Cedar Heights, information will be provided on design and construction related to repaving, water main, storm sewer, and sanitary sewer. Additionally, more specific information will be provided on planned reconstruction of Phase 2, which is Timber Drive from Grand Boulevard to Greenwood Avenue, and East Ridgewood Drive from Greenwood Avenue to Cherry Lane, and Woodland Drive. Doors will open with a brief presentation reviewing design requirements, scope, and expectations of the project, as well as construction phasing and timeline. Afterwards, a large plan view map will be available for viewing. West Viking Road. Information will be provided on construction from Union Road to Production Drive, related to the proposed timelines, project phasing that the work will involve, and construction storage equipment areas. Doors will open with a brief presentation, followed by a time for questions and answers. If you're wanting to ask any questions prior to the meeting or after, call the Engineering Division at area code 319-268-5161. Next, Independence receives donation. Dateline to Independence. Bank Iowa donated $50,000 to the Independence Baseball and Softball Complex for its turf infield project. The current complex has served the Independence community and surrounding area for over 40 years. With the new turf, the complex hopes to expand its services and youth sporting events without having to worry about the weather conditions. Last month, T-Mobile also awarded the city a $50,000 grant for the project. Next, Hudson School gets $100,000 grant. Dateline Hudson. The Hudson Community School District has received a $100,000 school safety improvement grant to improve video surveillance at its elementary and high school buildings. The grant, provided through the Iowa Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management under the Coronavirus State and Local Fiscal Recovery Fund, provides awards to school districts for minor capital improvements for security enhancements. Hudson Schools will install additional interior and exterior cameras. The district plans to have the project completed by August 2024. Bell ringers needed. Dateline Waterloo. The Salvation Army of Waterloo, Cedar Falls, is accepting applications for paid seasonal bell ringers. Those interested can apply in person at the Salvation Army office at 89 Franklin Street in Waterloo during normal business hours. The office is open 9 a.m. to noon and 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Monday through Thursday and 9 a.m. to noon on Friday. Bring a state ID and Social Security card to apply. The Red Kettle season begins November 6th and continues through December 23rd. For more information, call the office at area code 319-235-9358. And lastly here, the Northeast Iowa Food Bank garden yields 10,000 pounds. Dateline Waterloo. The Northeast Iowa Food Bank has announced a yield of over 10,000 pounds of fresh, locally grown produce in their most recent harvest. Since the establishment 8 years ago, the community garden has been a vital part of the food bank's mission. In collaboration with the Iowa State University Extension Office, the garden was conceived as a testament to the power of community collaboration and sustainable agricultural practices. Quote, the visitors in the pantry love the fresh produce, said Libby Halverson, Community Food Connections Coordinator at the food bank. And this achievement not only showcases the hard work and dedication of our master gardeners, but also allows us to provide fresh, nutritious produce while simultaneously taking one step closer to ensure that no one in our community goes hungry, unquote. For those interested in learning more about the Northeast Iowa Food Bank's 8 programs, volunteering opportunities, or ways to contribute, go online to neifb.org. And now, listeners, we'd like to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, October 27th, on IRIS, I-R-I-S. That's the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, this announcement.
What if, instead of looking down on people struggling with using drugs, we saw them as people instead? People who have interests and passions, people who have loved ones they care about, and loved ones who care about them. They have a very powerful illness, and they need help and support so they can live the life they want and deserve. See the person, not the addiction. Learn more at yourliveiowa.org, brought to you by the Iowa Department of Public Health.
And now let's turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial comes to us from the Storm Lake Times Pilot, editor Art Collin. From all reports, the crops are tremendous, considering the fourth year of severe drought in northwest Iowa. Quote, no complaints, said our farmer friend from Cherokee. So that's saying something. It is a wonder of technology, a testament to our rich soils, and a stroke of uncanny luck that we got the rain we needed just in the nick of time, in each of the past 4 years. Farmers across the Corn Belt are being pleasantly surprised by their yields after frightening drought. Of course, that means that corn prices are at 3-year lows, and U.S. farm income is expected to be off about a quarter from last year's record high. Lower feed costs will bring some relief to a troubled pork industry. There's a reason land around here is so frightfully expensive. It has an amazing capacity to produce, so long as we can preserve it. This next one is titled, Listening to the Rural Working Families. Storm Lake native Jesse Case and Teamsters Local 238 are set on amplifying the voices of rural Iowans around issues that are important to working families, like better schools, health care, roads, and labor rights. Case leads Iowa's largest local union out of Cedar Rapids and founded the community organizing group Team CAN. He said he's been listening to members the past couple years who believe that neither party represents them, especially in rural counties dominated by one party. Hence, some 700,000 Iowa registered voters opt out of the system. They are a group of experts at describing what rural Iowans are facing if anyone talked their language. Case has been listening for years. Quote, our members are fed up, Case said. They've had enough. Case is bringing together unions and community organizers to press a, quote, working families agenda to make sure the voices of his members are heard. The agenda is built from focus groups in rural counties and surveys of Teamsters members statewide. Top concerns are funding for K-12 education, after-school programs for students with both parents working, closing 175 rural hospitals in the past 20 years, Keokuk among them, mental health care, substance abuse, erosion of worker rights and protections, that includes collective bargaining, unemployment and workers' compensation, and basic local infrastructure. Case says that rural workers are keenly focused on bread and butter issues surrounding strong families. He said one focus group in Centerville identified residents upset about cutting its shop program at school. They want to know that a good hospital is near. They want their children to be in healthy environments after school. They fear meth and want counseling services to be available. They want to be heard, Case said. Quote, anytime you elevate voices of the voiceless, you can change policy, he said. Local 238 just came off a two-week strike with manufacturer Amcor. The United Auto Workers are striking the big three Detroit automakers. Gallup polling shows approval of unions at its highest point since 1965. Workers have the public's attention for the first time in a long time. Quote, we're seeing and feeling the excitement for this agenda, Case said. Workers want to know where they can sign on and take up the fight, unquote. He said that the pandemic made painfully clear how the working class was told it was essential, but workers weren't treated as if they were. It brought into relief the huge income gap between the wealthy, even in Iowa, and those who can barely afford to make rent. Here's the agenda's opening statement, quote, our two-party system is broken, and it is not serving the interests of working Iowans. Over 750,000 Iowans are registered independents and have chosen not to affiliate with our two main political parties. We have seen that leadership in Des Moines has continued to legislate and vote against the interests of their voters' constituents and have made life impossible for working Iowans, especially in our rural communities. Partisan interests, large corporations, and their lobbyists have a tight grip on our political system. We need to organize everyday workers to counteract the influence of big money on our state government. Our government must serve the interests of working people and not large corporations and the politicians they support, unquote. It argues against vouchers for private school families. Case said survey groups understand well the impact on education. It demands better roads and bridges. The agenda calls for restoration of bargaining rights in the workplace. Nothing fancy, but the message is powerful. Other unions are joining with the Teamsters. Quote, when workers are cornered, they fight back, Case said. Legislators who mindlessly vote for their corporate paymasters are not listening. Rural interests ignored for the last generation might finally get a hearing. Case doesn't mess around. Case is listening as his members in rural Iowa talk about what makes for a livable community. That is a threat to the existing order of things, which is the reason he gets up in the morning. Next, from the New York Times, Gail Collins. The speakership is yours, Mike Johnson. Good luck with that. The House Speaker mess was all Donald Trump's fault. Yeah, I know you're not going to argue with me if I blame him for something bad. Saturday night's block party was canceled because of the threat of rain and Donald Trump. Still, follow this thought. The House Republicans are a rancorous crew, and they've only got a 9-member majority, one of the tightest in recent history. We've been hearing all week that a mere 5 rebels can halt progress on anything, even a basic task like electing a speaker. Interesting how narrow that majority is. Normally, in non-presidential election years, the party that didn't win the White House gets a lift, often a huge one. Some voters are looking for balance. Others are just kind of bored. Given the deeply non-electric nature of Joe Biden's victory, you'd figure the Republicans would have made a scary sweep in 2022. But no. And one of the reasons was completely loopy candidates running on Republican lines in districts that should have been up for grabs. Some had been handpicked by Trump, like Beau Hines, a 28-year-old former college football star who moved into a North Carolina swing district a month before the May primary, won the nomination with the ex-president's enthusiastic support, and then, well, went down the drain. Trump endorsed 3 candidates in toss-up districts last year. All of them lost. Plus, there were lots of other dreadful Trump-backed contenders on the ballots, like Mehmet Oz, the longtime New Jersey resident who ran a disastrous race for the Senate in Pennsylvania and almost certainly pulled down the rest of his party's ticket. Here's a pop quiz. Donald Trump, who's facing 91 criminal charges around the country, is now on trial in New York for falsifying records to make himself look like an, non-failure in the real estate business. This week, he compared himself to a South African Nobel Peace Prize winner who served time in prison for his battles against apartheid. "I don't mind being Nelson Mandela because I'm doing it for a reason," unquote. He's also compared himself to Abraham Lincoln, Jesus, George Washington, the Mona Lisa. The answer is everybody but Jesus. And he did recently post a sketch on Truth Social showing Christ next to him in the courtroom. All that flailing over selecting a House Speaker was due, in part, to the Republicans' failure to corral their flimsy five around any of the original contenders. But it was also very, very much about Trump's lack of enthusiasm for logical candidates like Tom Emmer, the House Republican whip, who'd made the dreaded mistake of voting to certify the results of the last presidential election. Quote, "I have many wonderful friends wanting to be Speaker of the House, and some are truly great warriors," Trump declaimed. Quote, "Rhino Tom Emmer, who I do not know well, is not one of them. He never respected the power of a Trump endorsement," unquote. Rhino, of course, stands for Republican in name only, something Trump has truly hated ever since he registered as a Republican in Manhattan back in 1987. Until he registered with the Independence Party in 1999, followed by the Democratic Party in 2001. But hey, he became a Republican again in 2009, then dropped his party affiliation in 2011 and switched back to being a Republican in 2012. There is absolutely no reason to imagine he would ever switch again, unless, you know, there was something in it for him. Mike Johnson of Louisiana, who finally won the speaker's job, is exactly the kind of guy you'd expect to come up on top. Right-wing, anti-abortion activist, who gets along with his colleagues and who, critically, has items in his resume that won Trump's heart. A former radio talk host who helped lead the Republicans' battle to overturn the election results. What could be more perfect? Quote, "Get it done, fast, love, DJT," our ex-president posted on Truth Social. Earlier, once Emmer had crashed, Trump praised all the possible successors to the ousted Kevin McCarthy as, quote, "fine and very talented men," unquote. Quick question. What's missing in that description? One minor detail. The candidate swarm was notably lacking in female representation. Just saying. So the beat goes on. Mike Johnson's friends are celebrating. Much of the rest of the nation is wondering why the heck anybody would ever want to be Speaker of the House with its current crush of Republican crazies. Welcome to your new job, Mike. Hope you enjoyed your big day. Just remember that it won't be long before Congress has to pass another bill to keep the government operating or send the country teetering into disaster. Details, details. Next is a piece written by Paul Krugman of the New York Times, titled, "This is Your Brain on Crime." In 2022, according to FBI numbers, there were 370 violent crimes reported for every 100,000 Americans. Even allowing for some under-reporting, this likely means there was less than one violent crime for every 200 people. So the great majority of Americans haven't been victims lately, or probably ever. What this implies is that public views about crime needn't have much to do with personal experience. They may instead be shaped by impressions people pick up from the media, both news and social, and from politicians. In other words, perceptions about crime are like perceptions about the economy, perhaps more so. That is, they don't necessarily bear much relationship to to reality. Now, sometimes popular impressions are more or less right. Back in the 1970s and 1980s, when Hollywood was producing vigilante thrillers like Death Wish and dystopian sagas like Escape from New York, violent crime really was surging. However, violent crime began falling rapidly in the early 1990s for reasons that remain unclear. Whatever the source of the good news, there were two remarkable things about this decline. First, it was truly epic. As someone who has lived in New York since 2015, but visited it many times over previous decades, I can attest the city feels infinitely safer than it did in the bad old days. Second, most Americans didn't notice. Donald Trump devoted his 2017 inaugural address to the theme of American carnage, a supposed wave of violence sweeping our cities. At the time, actual urban violence was near a generational low point, but his rhetoric nonetheless resonated with many Americans. After all, throughout the epic decline in crime, voters kept telling pollsters that crime was rising nationally, although they were more sanguine about the crime in their own areas, about which they may have had more personal knowledge. And like views about the economy, perceptions about crime have a strong partisan element, with Republicans generally more likely to say that crime is rising, especially when a Democrat is president. In 2020 and 2021, it briefly looked as if Trump's dark vision might retroactively be coming true. There was, in fact, a surge in crime beginning in 2020, especially in murders. Unlike the somewhat mysterious decline in crime in previous decades, this crime wave wasn't too hard to explain. The COVID-19 pandemic led to a lot of isolation and disruption, plus a lot of psychological stress, making it plausible that some Americans became disconnected from the social bonds that usually keep most of us law-abiding. The big question was whether the post-COVID surge in crime would, like the post-COVID surge in inflation, prove transitory. Would crime keep rising, or would it subside back to relatively low levels? Well, the answer appears to be in, and it's encouraging. Murders dropped significantly in 2022, and so far seem to be falling even faster this year. Take the example of New York City, which had 319 murders in 2019, down from 2,262 in 1990. But saw that total rise to 488 in 2021. If trends this year continue, the number of murders in 2023 will probably be under 400, much of the way back to the low crime rates of the 2010s. I should acknowledge that while violent crime is clearly on the downswing, some forms of property crime are still running high. Many pharmacies in New York and other cities concerned about theft, now keep their products locked behind glass, which isn't scary, but is annoying. Still, America is clearly getting safer again, and is much safer than it was two decades ago. But if history is any guide, most voters won't believe it. Politicians will run campaigns promising to defend Americans against a terrifying crime wave, even as crime is receding nationwide. Wait, there's more. In addition to having false beliefs about trends in crime over time, many Americans have false beliefs about the geography of crime. In particular, Republicans often treat it as an established fact that blue states, and especially cities run by Democrats, have higher crime rates than red states and cities, with New York singled out for special opprobrium. Back in April, the Republican-controlled House Judiciary Committee held a field hearing on victims of violent crime in Manhattan. But the reality is that red states have consistently higher homicide rates than blue states. Most big cities are run by Democrats, but those run by Republicans don't have significantly lower crime. And New York City happens to have remarkably low crime, with a murder rate around half that of Republican-run cities like Miami and Fort Worth. My guess is that part of the reason for low crime in New York is the city's large immigrant population, because, contrary to another myth, immigrants are relatively law-abiding. Again, however, it's doubtful whether data or even the lived experiences of those of us who reside in places many Americans believe to be hellscapes will change many minds. So what's the moral of this story? The good news is that while many feared that America was about to experience a sustained resurgence of crime, at this point, we seem to be heading back to the pre-pandemic normal of fairly low crime. The bad news is that the politics of fear can work, even if there isn't much basis for those fears. Now from the Des Moines Register, disability awareness should be about value. The potential payoff of harnessing the lived experiences of persons with disabilities is powerful and game-changing. This column is Your Turn by Robert Ludke, a guest columnist. As we near the end of the National Disability Employment Month, it is obvious that the most important reason to celebrate disability employment has been overlooked. Disability employment is an executive-led, long-term organizational strategy that provides lasting value for shareholders and stakeholders alike. Too often, the private sector's focus on disability employment treats it as part of a corporate social responsibility campaign or compliance with legal mandates. There is a lot of attention given to employee resource groups, sensitivity training, and social media campaigns to tell the story of disability employment. Yes, those efforts are important and have a rightful place within every organization, but they are incremental steps, not a comprehensive approach to fostering greater disability employment across the economy. When disability employment is treated as a driver of long-term value creation, it has a proven ability to future-proof a business by opening trillions of dollars of global markets and innovating the next generation of goods and services able to meet human needs. Consider cruise control in vehicles, the text function or touch features on mobile phones, the electric toothbrush, and the internet. All were innovated by people with disabilities. Each innovation quickly found its way into the mainstream acceptance, enjoying widespread commercial success, and fostering a positive change in how billions of people work and live, regardless of disability status. Because persons with disabilities must constantly adapt into a society that is not always accessible to them, it is no wonder their innovative skills are more pronounced than most employees. For example, a study by COQUAL, formerly the Center for Talent Innovation, found that 75% of employees with disabilities in the United States have ideas that would drive value for their company, compared with 61% of employees without disabilities. Companies that harness the innovative potential of all their employees who identify as disabled stand to gain significant upside benefits. Research by Return on Disability found that the global population of persons with disabilities and their close friends and families is roughly 3.4 billion people, more than double China's population. Their spending power is over $13 trillion. Achieving a disability-inclusive business strategy starts at the top, with the CEO and board of directors. Only when leaders communicate their connection to disability will all employees feel comfortable doing so. This is not an act of charity or pity. Just imagine the value created if employees with disabilities are given permission to rechannel the ingenuity of masking disability to applying the traits of creativity, resourcefulness, and resilience to their jobs. Here are a few more ideas that connect disability employment to innovation and, ultimately, to business strategy. collaborate with suppliers to foster disability inclusion in supply chains. Rethink your approach to design and innovation. Innovation throughout the global economy is stunted because it is not open to a diverse set of entrepreneurs and employees. Persons with disabilities are innovating every day, so use their talents. Partner with local organizations that specialize in placing talent with disabilities into the workforce, and appreciate the intersectional nature of disability when doing so. Potential partners can be found working with veterans, people identifying as LGBTQ, or low-income populations. Engage a team of experts in accessible design so that inclusive design concepts are incorporated into physical office spaces. The potential payoff of harnessing the lived experiences of persons with disabilities is powerful and game-changing. Disability inclusion is not a compliance mandate or a niche market opportunity. Instead, it can unlock transformative solutions worth trillions of dollars and make society better far into the future. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, October 27th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can access a recording of today's reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just go to our website, that is iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.